For the Love of Reading, featuring selections from novels, complete short stories, poetry, and nonfiction, read for you by Linda Pack. Discovering the joys of your own backyard. There are so many surprising ways it happens. Sometimes by cultivating the land, sometimes by leaving it entirely and then returning, or, as in many of Willa Cather's novels, by absorbing it from the earth around you, directly through your bones. By the way, if you are searching for the great American novel, you need look no further than Willa Cather. She wrote several. And it is perhaps true that My Antonia, which was written in 1918, is the most beloved. The story begins in the late 1880s in Nebraska and focuses on the life of a Czechoslovakian immigrant girl as she comes of age with the land, as seen through the eyes of an old and true friend. Here is a selection from the beginning chapters of Willa Cather's novel, My Antonia. I first heard of Antonia on what seemed to me an interminable journey across the great Midland Plain of North America. I was 10 years old then. I had lost both my father and mother within a year, and my Virginia relatives were sending me out to my grandparents, who lived in Nebraska. I traveled in the care of a mountain boy, Jake Marpole, one of the hands on my father's old farm under the Blue Ridge, who was now going west to work for my grandfather. Jake's experience of the world was not much wider than mine. He'd never been in a railway train until the morning when we set out together to try our fortunes in a new world. We went all the way in day coaches, becoming more sticky and grimy with each stage of the journey. Jake bought everything the newsboys offered him: candy, oranges, brass collar buttons, a watch charm, and for me, a Life of Jesse James, which I remember as one of the most satisfactory books I have ever read. Beyond Chicago, we were under the protection of a friendly passenger conductor who knew all about the country to which we were going and gave us a great deal of advice in exchange for our confidence. He seemed to us an experienced and worldly man who had been almost everywhere. In his conversation, he threw out lightly the names of distant states and cities. Once, when he sat down to chat, he told us that in the immigrant car ahead, there was a family from across the water, whose destination was the same as ours. They can't any of them speak English, except one little girl, and all she can say is, "We go Black Hawk, Nebraska." She's not much older than you, 12 or 13 maybe, and she's as bright as a new dollar. Don't you want to go ahead and see her, Jimmy? She's got the pretty brown eyes, too. This last remark made me bashful, and I shook my head and settled down to Jesse James. Jake nodded at me approvingly and said, "You were likely to get diseases from foreigners." I do not remember crossing the Missouri River or anything about the long day's journey through Nebraska. The only thing very noticeable about Nebraska was that it was still, all day long, Nebraska. I'd been sleeping curled up in a red plush seat for a long while when we reached Black Hawk. Jake roused me and took me by the hand. We stumbled down from the train to a wooden siding where men were running about with lanterns. I couldn't see any town or even distant lights. We were surrounded by utter darkness. The engine was panting heavily after its long run. In the red glow from the firebox, a group of people stood huddled together on the platform, encumbered by bundles and boxes. I knew this must be the immigrant family the conductor had told us about. Presently, a man with a lantern approached them and began to talk, shouting and exclaiming. I pricked up my ears, for it was positively the first time I had ever heard a foreign tongue. Another lantern came along. A bantering voice called out, "Hello, are you Mr. Burden's folks? If you are, it's me you're looking for. I'm Otto Fuchs. I'm Mr. Burden's hired man, and I'm to drive you out. Hello, Jimmy. Ain't you scared to come so far west?" I looked up with interest at the new face in the lantern light. He might have stepped out of the pages of Jesse James. He wore a sombrero hat with a wide leather band and a bright buckle, and the ends of his mustache were twisted up stiffly like little horns. Surely this was the face of a desperado. He told us we had a long night drive ahead of us and we'd better be on the hike. He led us to a hitching bar where two farm wagons were tied, and I saw the foreign family crowding into one of them. The other one was for us. Jake got on the front seat with Otto Fuchs, and I rode on the straw in the bottom of the wagon box, covered up with a buffalo hide. The immigrants rumbled off into the empty darkness, and we followed them. I tried to go to sleep, but the jolting made me bite my tongue, and I soon began to ache all over. Cautiously, I slipped from under the buffalo hide, got up on my knees, and peered over the side of the wagon. There seemed to be nothing to see. No fences, no creeks or trees, no hills or fields. If there was a road, I could not make it out in the faint starlight. There was nothing but land. Not a country at all, but the material out of which countries are made. No, there was nothing but land. Slightly undulating, I knew, because often our wheels ground against the brake as we went down into a hollow and lurched up again on the other side. I had the feeling that the world was left behind, that we had got over the edge of it, when we were outside man's jurisdiction. I had never before looked up at the sky when there was not a familiar mountain ridge against it. But this was the complete dome of heaven, all there was of it. I did not believe that my dead father and mother were watching me from up there. They would still be looking for me at the sheepfold down by the creek or along the white road that led to the mountain pastures. I'd even left their spirits behind me. The wagon jolted on, carrying me I knew not whither. I don't think I was homesick. If we never arrived anywhere, it did not matter. Between that earth and that sky, I felt erased, blotted out. I did not say my prayers that night. Here I felt what would be, would be. I do not remember our arrival at my grandfather's farm sometime before daybreak, after a drive of nearly 20 miles with heavy workhorses. When I awoke, it was afternoon. I was lying in a little room scarcely larger than the bed that held me, and the window shade at my head was flapping softly in a warm wind. A tall woman with wrinkled brown skin and black hair stood looking down at me. I knew that she must be my grandmother. She had been crying, I could see, but when I opened my eyes, she smiled, peering at me anxiously, and sat down at the foot of my bed. "Had a good sleep, Jimmy?" she asked briskly. And then in a very different tone, she said, as if to herself, "My, how you do look like your father." I remembered that my father had been her little boy. She must often have come to wake him like this when he overslept. "Here are your clean clothes," she went on, stroking my coverlid with her brown hand as she talked. "But first you come down to the kitchen with me and have a nice warm bath behind the stove. Bring your things. There's nobody about." As I entered the kitchen, I sniffed the pleasant smell of gingerbread baking. The stove was very large, with bright nickel trimmings, and behind it was a long wooden bench against the wall and a tin washtub into which Grandmother poured hot and cold water. When she brought the soap and towels, I told her that I was used to taking my bath without help. "Can you do your ears, Jimmy? You sure? Well, now, I call you a right smart little boy." Early the next morning, I ran out of doors to look about me. I had been told that ours was the only wooden house west of Black Hawk, until you came to the Norwegian settlement, where there were several. Our neighbors lived in sod houses and dugouts, comfortable, but not very roomy. Everywhere, as far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but rough, shaggy, red grass, most of it as tall as I. little trees were insignificant against the grass. It seemed as if the grass were about to run over them and over the plum patch behind the sod chicken house. As I looked about me, I felt that the grass was the country, as the water is the sea. The red of the grass made all the great prairie the color of wine stains or of certain seaweeds when they're first washed up. And there was so much motion in it. The whole country seemed somehow to be running. I'd almost forgotten I had a grandmother when she came out, her sunbonnet on her head, a grain sack in her hand, and asked me if I did not want to go to the garden with her to dig potatoes for dinner. The garden, curiously enough, was a quarter of a mile from the house, and the way to it led up a shallow draw past the cattle corral. Grandmother called my attention to a stout hickory cane tipped with copper that hung by a leather thong from her belt. "This," she said, "was her rattlesnake cane. I must never go to the garden without a heavy stick or a corn knife. She'd killed many a good rattlers on her way back and forth. A little girl who lived on the Black Hawk Road was bitten on the ankle and had been sick all summer." I can remember exactly how the country looked to me as I walked beside my grandmother along the faint wagon tracks in that early September morning. Perhaps the glide of long railway travel was still with me, for more than anything else, I felt motion in the landscape, in the fresh, easy-blowing morning wind, and in the earth itself, as if the shaggy grass were a sort of loose hide, and underneath it herds of wild buffalo were galloping, galloping. Alone, I should never have found the garden, except perhaps for the big yellow pumpkins that lay about unprotected by their withering vines. And I felt very little interest in it when I got there. I wanted to walk straight on through the red grass and over the edge of the world, which could not be very far away. The light air about me told that the world ended here. Only the ground and sun and sky were left, and if I went a little further, there would be only sun and sky, and one would float off into them like the tawny hawks which sailed over our heads making slow shadows on the grass. While Grandmother took the pitchfork we found standing in one of the rows and dug potatoes, while I picked them up out of the soft brown earth and put them into the bag, I kept looking up at the hawks that were doing what I might so easily do. When Grandmother was ready to go, I said I would like to stay up there in the garden a while. She peered down at me from under her sunbonnet. "Aren't you afraid of snakes?" "A little," I admitted, "but I'd like to stay anyhow." "Well, if you see one, don't have anything to do with him. The big yellow and brown ones won't hurt you. They're bull snakes and help to keep the gophers down. Don't be scared if you see anything. Look out of that big hole in the bank over there. That's a badger hole. He's about as big as a possum, and his face is striped black and white. He takes a chicken once in a while, but I won't let the men harm him. In a new country, a body feels friendly to the animals. I like to have him come out and watch me when I'm at work." Grandmother swung the bag of potatoes over her shoulder and went down the path, leaning forward a little. The road followed the windings of the draw, and when she came to the first bend, she waved at me and disappeared. I was left alone with this new feeling of lightness and content. I sat down in the middle of the garden, where snakes could scarcely approach unseen, and leaned my back against a warm yellow pumpkin. There were some ground cherry bushes growing along the furrows full of fruit. I turned back the papery triangular sheaths that protected the berries and ate a few. All about me, giant grasshoppers, twice as big as any that I had ever seen, were doing acrobatic feats among the dried vines. The gophers scurried up and down the plowed ground. There, in the sheltered draw bottom, the wind did not blow very hard, but I could hear it singing its humming tune up on the level, and I could see the tall grasses wave. The earth was warm under me, and warm as I crumbled it through my fingers. queer little red bugs came out and moved in slow squadrons around me. Their backs were polished vermilion with black spots. I kept as still as I could. Nothing happened. I did not expect anything to happen. I was something that lay under the sun and felt it, like the pumpkins, and I did not want to be anything more. I was entirely happy. Perhaps we feel like that when we die and become a part of something entire, whether it is sun and air or goodness and knowledge. At any rate, that is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great. When it comes to one, it comes as naturally as sleep. You've just heard a selection from the opening chapters of My Antonia by Willa Cather. Well, one great Nebraskan story leads to another in my mind. Carl Sandburg, the great American poet and historian who won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 for his poetry and 1 for his monumental 7-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. Carl Sandburg, who collected 280 folk songs and ballads in his epic American Song Bag, who was a genius at understanding and using the American language, also created a whimsical world that was inspired by the American heartland and solely for the entertainment and delight of his 3 young daughters. The Rutabaga Stories. So here from his fantastical collection, Rutabaga Pigeons, is The Huckabuck Family and How They Raised Popcorn in Nebraska and Quit and Came Back. Jonas Huckabuck was a farmer in Nebraska with a wife, Mama Huckabuck, and a daughter, Pony Huckabuck. "Your father gave you 2 names the same in front," people said to him, and he answered, "Yes, 2 names are easier to remember. If you call me by my first name, Jonas, and I don't hear you, then when you call me by my second name, Jonas, maybe I will." "And," he went on, "I call my pony-faced girl Pony, because if she doesn't hear me the first time, she always does the second." And so they lived on a farm where they raised popcorn, these 3, Jonas Huckabuck, and his wife, Mama Huckabuck, and their pony-faced daughter, Pony Huckabuck. After they harvested the crop 1 year, they had the barns, the cribs, the sheds, the shacks, and all the cracks and corners of the farm all filled with popcorn. "We came out to Nebraska to raise popcorn," said Jonas, "and I guess we got nearly enough popcorn this year for the popcorn poppers and all the friends and relations of all the popcorn poppers in these United States." And this was the year Pony was going to bake her first squash pie all by herself. In 1 corner of the corn crib, all covered over with popcorn, she had a secret, a big round squash, a fat yellow squash, a rich squash all spotted with spots of gold. She carried the squash into the kitchen, took a long, sharp, shining knife, and then she cut the squash in the middle till she had 2 big half squashes. And inside, just like the outside, it was rich yellow, spotted with spots of gold. And there was a shine of silver. And Pony wondered why silver should be in a squash. She picked and plunged with her fingers until she pulled it out. "It's a buckle," she said. "A silver buckle, a Chinese silver slipper buckle." She ran with it to her father and said, "Look what I found when I cut open the yellow golden squash spotted with gold spots. It is a Chinese silver slipper buckle." "It means our luck's going to change, and we don't know whether it will be good luck or bad luck," said Jonas to his daughter, Pony Huckabuck. Then she ran with it to her mother and said, "Look what I found when I cut open the yellow squash spotted with spots of gold. It is a Chinese silver slipper buckle." It means our luck is going to change, and we don't know whether it will be good luck or bad luck," said Mama Huckabuck. And that night, a fire started in the barns, cribs, sheds, shacks, cracks, and corners where the popcorn harvest was kept. All night long, the popcorn popped. In the morning, the ground all around the farmhouse and the barn was covered with white popcorn, so it looked like a heavy fall of snow. All the next day, the fire kept on, and the popcorn popped till it was up to the shoulders of Pony Pony when she tried to walk from the house to the barn. And that night, in all the barns, cribs, sheds, shacks, cracks, and corners of the farm, the popcorn went on popping. In the morning, when Jonas Huckabuck looked out of the upstairs window, he saw the popcorn popping and coming higher and higher. It was nearly up to the window. Before evening and dark of that day, Jonas Huckabuck and his wife, Mama Huckabuck, and their daughter, Pony Pony Huckabuck, all went away from the farm, saying, "We came to Nebraska to raise popcorn, but this is too much. We will not come back till the wind blows away the popcorn. We will not come back until we get a sign and a signal." They went to Oskaloosa, Iowa. And the next year, Pony Pony Huckabuck was very proud, because when she stood on the sidewalks in the street, she could see her father sitting high on the seat of a coal wagon, driving two big spanking horses hitched with shining brass harness in front of the coal wagon. And though Pony Pony and Jonas were proud, very proud, all that year, there never came a sign, a signal. The next year again was a proud year, exactly as proud a year as they spent in Oskaloosa. They went to Paducah, Kentucky, to Defiance, Ohio, Peoria, Illinois, Indianapolis, Indiana, Walla Walla, Washington. And in all these places, Pony Pony Huckabuck saw her father, Jonas Huckabuck, standing in rubber boots deep down in a ditch with a shining steel shovel shoveling yellow clay and black mud from down in the ditch high, high up over his shoulders. And though it was a proud year, they got no sign, no signal. The next year came. It was the proudest of all. This was the year Jonas Huckabuck and his family lived in Elgin, Illinois, and Jonas Huckabuck was a watchman in a watch factory watching the watches. "I know where you have been," Mama Huckabuck would say of an evening to Pony Pony Huckabuck. "You have been down to the watch factory watching your father watch the watches." "Yes," said Pony Pony. "Yes, and this evening, when I was watching Father watch the watches in the watch factory, I looked over my left shoulder and I saw a policeman with a star and brass buttons, and he was watching me to see if I was watching Father watch the watches in the watch factory." It was a proud year. Pony Pony saved her money. Thanksgiving came. Pony Pony said, "I am going to get a squash to make a squash pie." She hunted from one grocery to another. She kept her eyes on the farm wagons coming into Elgin with squashes. She found what she wanted, the yellow squash spotted with gold spots. She took it home, cut it open, and saw the inside was like the outside, all rich yellow spotted with gold spots. There was a shine like silver. She picked and plunged with her fingers and pulled until at last she pulled out the shine of silver. "It is a sign. It is a signal," she said. "It is a buckle, a slipper buckle, a Chinese silver slipper buckle. It is the mate to the other buckle. Our luck is going to change. Yoo-hoo, yoo-hoo!" She told her father and mother about the buckle. They went back to the farm in Nebraska. The wind by this time had been blowing and blowing for 3 years, and all the popcorn was blown away. "Now we're going to be farmers again," said Jonas Huckabuck to Mama Huckabuck and to Pony Pony Huckabuck. And we are going to raise cabbages, beets, and turnips. We are going to raise squash, rutabaga, pumpkins, and peppers for pickling. We are going to raise wheat, oats, barley, rye. We are going to raise corn, such as Indian corn and kaffir corn. But we are not going to raise any popcorn for the popcorn poppers to be popping. And the pony-faced daughter, Pony Pony Huckabuck, was proud because she had on new black slippers, and around her ankles, holding the slippers on the left foot and the right foot, she had two buckles, silver buckles, Chinese silver slipper buckles. They were mates. Sometimes, on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas and New Year's, she tells her friends to be careful when they open a squash. Squashes make your luck change from good to bad, and bad to good, says Pony Pony. You have just heard the Huckabuck Family and How They Raised Popcorn in Nebraska and Quit and Came Back by Carl Sandburg. I wondered, after reading that story, if there was popcorn in my garden. So I went out into my own backyard and I looked at my garden. There was no popcorn, but I thought it could use some help. So I opened up my Sunset Western garden book, and a piece of paper fluttered out. And on it was, by the ever-surprising Czech writer Karel Čapek, A Gardener's Prayer. O Lord, grant that in some way it may rain every day, say from about midnight until 3 o'clock in the morning. But you see, it must be gentle and warm so that it can soak in. Grant that at the same time it would not rain on campion, alyssum, helianthemum, lavender, and the others, which you, in your infinite wisdom, know are drought-loving plants. I can write their names on a bit of paper if you like. And grant that the sun may shine the whole day long, but not everywhere and not too much, that there might be plenty of dew and little wind, enough worms, no plant lice and snails, no mildew, and that once a week thin liquid manure and guano may fall from heaven. Amen. And that is The Gardener's Prayer by Karel Čapek. And that is all for this edition of For the Love of Reading, Your Own Backyard. The material read on For the Love of Reading was selected, reviewed, edited, and performed by Linda Pack. The program was engineered by Alicia Bales. This program is archived and available for online listening at kzyx.org. There you will also find a bibliography of the readings heard on this edition of For the Love of Reading.